We're not going to have an elongated QA discussion to start today, but I did have a couple that I got in my inbox, or the white box, that I just wanted to share. These are really, one of them is more of a comment than a question, but I thought it was valuable. Yesterday we were talking about Jonah and his conflict with God, and then with the Ninevites, and then with the ship crew. Well, this individual wrote, "The way I read the story of Jonah is his conflict with God was that he didn't want God to have mercy on the people of Nineveh." And I would agree with that. Then it says, "Is it possible that many of us have the same conflict with God when we pick and choose who we should talk to about the gospel?" And I think that's, I took that as a little bit of a rhetorical question, but I thought it was a good question or a good comment. We don't have the right any more than Jonah to pick who we share the word with. We share it with everybody we have an opportunity. And I don't think for most of us, at least my opinion, that it's an ethnic issue. It may be more of a socioeconomic issue that many of us would struggle with. But absolutely, every soul is precious, no matter where it is and how much money it has, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought that I agreed with the comments and the question, and I wanted to share that. The other one goes back a couple of days, and I do want to comment on this, although it won't take me long because I don't know too much to say on it. We had the question about how public should our confessions be, and I made the statement that I thought confession should be as public as the sin. And if it's a private sin, you go to the Lord and ask for forgiveness. If it's known in the community or in the congregation or whatever, then you need to make it right, at least to that extent. This person wrote the question, "If you don't confess a public sin in public, but you confess it in private, is that sin still forgiven?" I take this to mean it's a sin that is known about by multiple people, and yet you just go to the Lord and pray for forgiveness. Well, my official answer is I'm going to let the Lord decide whether he forgives that or not, but I would not be comfortable with that, and I would not encourage that. And I would ask myself the question, why do I not want to make that right publicly? And there are multiple reasons, but in my humble opinion, none of them are good. It's hard for me to come up with a good reason why I would not want to make a sin right publicly that people know. Now, I know why I might not want to, embarrassment and whatever, but if I'm truly sorry and repentant, I think with that would come the desire to do whatever is needed to make sure that is taken care of. And I believe our congregations have the right to know when we have changed, which repentance really is. How are they going to know? How is the brotherhood going to know? I had a case down in Kansas City, it's been several years ago, where an individual was a member of one congregation, had done various things sinfully that had caused him to be disfellowshipped and no longer considered a member. He then came to Smart Road, where I'm a member, and went forward and confessed his sin and wanted to make things right with the Lord. That's absolutely wonderful. We welcomed him. But then we asked him to go back to his previous congregation and let them know of this change of heart, because we felt they had the right to know. And he was more than willing to do that. So I think that I stand by it should be as public as the sin. Yes, public confessions and ask for help are not easy for most of us. But when I ask myself, why would one not want to do that? I don't get a good answer that makes me comfortable. I get answers like, well, it's embarrassing or what. Well, yeah, might be. But embarrassment's a lot better than hell. Does anybody want to make a comment or a question on either one of those? That's really all I have to say about it, unless your comments spur something. Lewis? Can you hear him? Okay. Why don't you stand this side of the curtain?
Some years ago, there was a situation where a sister made kind of a vague acknowledgement, and I felt like whatever it was going on in the because I went to work, and a couple of months later, one of the guys at work happened to know a little bit about the situation, more than I did, or at least it seemed like. And he said something very derogatory about the sister. And I felt like I had legs cut out from under me. I was very much in line with what he said. No, this was voiced publicly, she acknowledged this. Whatever the situation, I wouldn't like to stood behind her and intend for her to know her integrity. And I was unable to do that because I was in the dark.
Yeah. I think sometimes the reputation of the church somewhat is at stake, you know. The community knows I've done something wrong, but the church accepts me back, that's fine. But the members of our congregation ought to say, well, if it comes up, like Lewis said, they ought to be able to say, well, they have repented of that, rather than the community getting the idea, well, that church doesn't consider sin very seriously because they just let people remain members who are not, even by the world standards, living appropriately. So I think that is an issue. Anybody else care to make a question or a comment on either one of those? Okay. I've got two or three little vignettes, and that does not mean they are short, but I'm going to try to get more than one of them in today. And what I've done on this first one is start with the slide that you've seen many, many times, but we keep having new people. Our subject is Christian leadership, and I'm defining that as influence. If you're a Christian and have influence, you are, to that extent, a leader. And I believe that includes everybody here. You can be a bad leader, good leader, great leader, but it is not an option to be a non-leader. Sometimes it might be better if we were non-leaders. I just don't think it's an option. Because we're always following someone, which is another way of saying someone is always in charge. I'm going to just talk a little bit about some of what I might consider, in the Bible, perils or dangers of leadership. I think to be a leader, a good leader, is a wonderful thing, whether it's an official office in the church, whether it's in the home, whether it's unofficial, and it's just the influence we have on various ones. And God has always tested His leaders. In Genesis 22, Abraham was tested. In Matthew chapter 4, Jesus was tested, the three temptations. They passed. I don't know that we always do. The first one I put up here, and we had a lesson on this last night with Steve, on compromise. It is a peril, it is a danger, and leaders are tempted to compromise. Not to get into Charles's material, but parents are tempted not to discipline. Well, that's a form of compromise. Churches are sometimes tempted not to discipline when they should. Lowering the standard is always a backward step. And compromise nearly always requires that we take a backward step. I'm going to go back to Exodus chapters 8 and 10 to look at a familiar story, but one which I see Moses being greatly tempted to compromise. To his credit, he doesn't. But Pharaoh puts forth a very, I don't know if it was intentional or not, but a very subtle effort to get Moses to compromise. Now you remember Moses went to Pharaoh and his initial request was, let the people go and worship their Lord. That was his initial request. Well, in Exodus chapter 8, verses 25 and 26, it says, and Pharaoh called for Moses and for Aaron and said, go ye sacrifice to your Lord in the land. And Moses said, it is not suitable so to do, for we shall sacrifice For shall we sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians to the Lord our God? Lo, shall we sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians before their eyes? And will they not stone us? Now what happened in those two verses? Moses has said, let us go and worship God. Pharaoh says, fine, but don't go. Just do it here. Pharaoh says, okay, it's okay if you want to worship your God, but do it here in Egypt. Don't go anywhere. And Moses rejects that offer. Maybe a modern day equivalent might be something along the lines, religion is okay, but don't be narrow about it. There is no need to let your religion separate you from the rest of the world. And that is the way many people try to practice their religion. Well, we'll just do it here. Now, I know we're of this world and we can't automatically leave this world, but we are in a sense to be separated. That's what sanctification means. Moses says no. Now when I drop down to verses 28 and 29 of this 8th chapter, we find kind of phase 2. And Pharaoh said, I will let you go that you may sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness, only you shall not go very far away and pray for me. And Moses said, behold, I go out from thee and will entreat the Lord that the swarms of the flies may depart. Moses is still saying, let us go and worship. Now Pharaoh comes back and says, okay, you can go, but don't go very far. Still trying to get Moses to compromise. Number 3 comes in chapter 10, verses 7 through 10. And Pharaoh's servants said unto him, how long shall this man be a snare unto us? Let the men go, that they may serve the Lord. Now you notice what Pharaoh said? Let the men go. Moses wanted the people to go. He said, okay, the men go, but the women and children stay here. I can understand Pharaoh's thinking. Okay, that'll make sure they come back. But it's another way of trying to get Moses to compromise. In verse 24, Pharaoh gives a little bit. And Pharaoh called Moses and said, go ye serve the Lord, only let your flocks and your herds stay. There's this continual tempting of Moses to not do precisely what the Lord had said they needed to do. And Pharaoh gave a little bit, but he never allowed Moses to do what the Lord wanted him to do. And Moses' response in verse 26 of the 10th chapter, our cattle also shall go with us. There shall not an hoof be left behind. In other words, Moses said, no sail. We're either going lock, stock, and barrel, or you know what happened. He didn't go. That ever-present temptation to compromise, and in leadership, at whatever level and in whatever environment, there is that tremendous temptation to compromise. And it may well tie back to what we talked about yesterday, the avoidance of conflict. Because when we compromise, now there are times in which areas of judgment that aren't doctrine, sure, we don't all get our way all of the time, and compromise is the loving thing to do, but not when it's been told by God what we should do. Ambition. And I chose Numbers chapter 14. Really, I should have put verses 11 and 12 up there. I just put 12, but I'm going to read verse 11 as well. God gives Moses I call it a divine proposal. And I think this is Moses at one of his best times. The Lord has gotten very upset with the children of Israel. So upset that he at least articulates a willingness or a temptation to just destroy the Israelites and start over with Moses. And we'll notice in verse 11, and Moses said unto the Lord, wherefore hast thou, chapter 14, verse 11. And the Lord said unto Moses, how long will this people provoke me, and how long will it be ere they believe me for all the signs which I have shown them? The Lord says, I will smite them with a pestilence and disinherit them. Now listen to this next phrase. And I will make of you a greater nation mightier than thee. The Lord is saying, I am so upset with them, I'll just wipe them out, and Moses, I'll make a great nation from you. Now, wouldn't that appeal to our ego and our ambition? To Moses' credit, and you can read the rest of this chapter to refresh your memory, he doesn't want the Lord to do that. A chance for it to be the children of Moses, if you will. One of Moses' greatest leadership moments. Instead of self-grandizement, Moses showed genuine concern for the Lord's glory and his people, even though they were misguided. Moses put his people ahead of his own ambition and his own self. I think that is a tremendously important characteristic of true godly leadership. One more and then I'll pause if you have any comments. This one has to do with failure or discouragement. Anybody that has led has not always led successfully, and they've gotten discouraged. I think that may well be one of the reasons Paul writes in Galatians 6, "Be ye not weary in well-doing." People just don't always do what we want them to do. Well, if you're a Christian and a godly leader, welcome to God's Word. But how a leader handles failure and disappointment, I think, sets the real foundation for the future. Peter appeared washed up as a leader after his denial. Who would have thought Peter would have played the role that he did in the book of Acts and following after that denial? When you look at what Peter did and Judas Iscariot did, I don't think one was better than the other. Is it better to deny Christ verbally or to turn him in? Well, I think they're equally bad. But the difference was how Peter handled that very, very poor situation and how Judas Iscariot handled it. Leaders must deal with failure, and they must deal with their own failure. The test is, now what do I do? Well, good leaders, great leaders, learn from that and move on. Average leaders, bad leaders, sometimes just throw in the towel. And we've all seen people in the church pull back from roles of influence that they ought to be involved in. Successful leaders have learned that no failure needs to be final, whether it's his own or whether it is someone else. I hope to have time today or tomorrow to talk about Barnabas, because when you talk about developing leaders, Barnabas was one of the classic examples, the way he took Paul under his wing and John Mark. It's an interesting character study. But I think one of the things I learned from the study of Barnabas is that he didn't allow other people's failures to necessarily make him conclude they could never be successful. And so we see one of the great encouragers and developers of leaders. No one is perfect. No one is right all of the time. Sometimes we set our expectations too high of our leaders. Sometimes they may set their expectations of us too high. But how we handle those disappointments is extremely, extremely important. The worth of a man must be measured by his life, not by his failure under a singular and peculiar trial. This man wrote, "Peter the Apostle, though forewarned three times, denied the Master at the first alarm of danger. And yet that Master, who knew his nature in its strength and in its weakness, chose him." Successful leaders have learned that no failure needs to be final. Rather, whether it's his failure or someone else's. Now, I've got some more on this list, but I'm going to pause just not to get too many up here to see if anybody has a comment or a question on anything that I've said regarding these three so far. Tom.
Leadership, I like your point about how nobody's right all the time. And I wonder if you want to comment on Barnabas, for example. His strength was his ability to encourage. And yet, I wonder if that sort of became a weakness, why he went along with Peter.
Okay, Tom's comment was Barnabas had several good characteristics in terms of encouraging, but maybe in some way that was part of his weakness as he went along with Peter. I view his engagement with Peter's activity as a weakness. I don't know that I'd ever tied those two together. I'd be happy for...
It seems like strengths often have a downside too.
Okay. He said, oftentimes strengths have a downside, and I do agree with that. Remember last week when we were talking about leadership styles? If you are an autocratic, take charge type of a leader, that's what you want when your flock is being accosted by false teaching. But it is not always what you want in every circumstance. And if you don't have the ability to be adaptable and flexible, not compromising, but adaptable and flexible, you will be quite limited in your leadership ability. And probably is one of the reasons why the Lord feels so strongly about a plurality of elders and a plurality of officers. Anybody else care to make a comment or ask a question? Okay, I put jealousy up here, and it'd be kind of nice not to put that up there, but I just think it belongs. And I put Numbers 11, 27, and 28. This is a case where Moses' own family, this is prior to that in chapter 12, but in verses 27, 28, and 29, individuals come to Moses and they say, that there's people out there that are prophesying. And in the end of 28 in chapter 11, they say, Lord Moses, notice they say Lord, not Lord, Lord Moses, forbid them. Okay? And Moses says, leave them alone. Leave them alone. Now, I suspect there was some jealousy involved there. And sometimes that can happen. And we have a case in the New Testament that jumps out where Jesus' disciples got upset because another group was doing something and it wasn't in their sphere of comfort. And Jesus basically says, you know, they're telling the truth or they're teaching. I'm paraphrasing, but you remember the account. And I don't know if jealousy was involved there or not, but it could have been. Well, it's not uncommon for leaders, as we lead, and again, we all do that, to have jealousy. You know, what sometimes upsets us about other people is they're doing it instead of us. You know, if you're ever at a party and somebody else is the life of the party and you get upset about that, well, there's some good reasons to get upset about that. It may just be stupid. But sometimes people get upset about that because they want to be the life of the party. Someone's taken over that role. That's an element of jealousy. I don't even like to talk about this one in a church context, but I see it. When I go to Numbers 12, that's the time when Aaron and you remember the account of I'll get it, Aaron and Miriam getting jealous or being critical of Moses. The Lord doesn't take well with that. Now, how much jealousy fit in there, I don't know. But I have to believe it was a part of it. One of my favorite Old Testament characters, and some of you have heard me say that, is Caleb. Remember the two spies that went and came back? Joshua and Caleb. Now, Joshua was chosen to replace Moses and lead. Caleb wasn't. I don't know why Caleb wasn't chosen. God had a reason. There's no indication in Scripture that he probably couldn't have done it. And there's indication that he remained very faithful. When he's 85, he says, give me that mountain and I'll conquer it. What I really like about Caleb is he didn't grouse around and pout and get bent out of shape because Joshua was chosen instead of him. Okay, men, there will be times in your congregation when somebody else may be chosen for formal leadership rather than you, and you may not understand why. But how you react to that is going to tell a lot about you as a person. And ladies, there'll be times when you won't understand why your husband's not chosen or you're not chosen to do a task. Well, just make sure it's not a jealousy issue, because that has no place in our hearts, even though it's there many times. Tom? Okay. Yeah, he's one of the... Well, he is the first judge, isn't he? Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar. Okay. Pride. I don't know the cure for this. other than just to remind ourselves incessantly of how bad it is. But it is a peril, it is a danger of leadership to be taken over with pride. Proverbs 16:5. By mercy and truth, iniquity is purged, and by the fear of God, the Lord's men depart from evil. Pride is one of those things that is extremely difficult to deal with. But if it is unchecked, it will disqualify a person for leadership. And even if we're not technically disqualified, it will make that person ineffective. When a person rises in position, the tendency is for pride to also increase. And I don't think anything grieves or angers the Lord more than pride. It's the sin that sets self on the throne and relegates God to a second place role, if not lower. I think that's the essence of why it is so terrible. The next one I put up there is very similar. Well, I didn't put it up there. It was so similar. So forget that one. I put egotism up there, which is closely related. I put it in my notes. And it's a repulsive manifestation of pride, the practice of thinking and speaking of self and magnifying self rather than God. And we can look at various organizations, we can look at other religious organizations, and we can cringe and criticize how their leaders have become prideful. I'm just saying we need to also be careful that we don't allow that to happen. This is not my church. This is not your church. And I'm going to be very candid with you. I cringe when people get up and start telling us in public all the things their church does. They may be wonderful, but that makes me very, 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 very uncomfortable. Now, there is an opportunity at a time to share ideas and thoughts, but I don't need an infomercial. I need the Bible. Popularity. What leader, what person doesn't want to be liked by people? Being disliked is not a virtue, but popularity can require a high price. Jesus warned, "Woe unto you when all men speak well of you." I've never had that happen. I've had some people speak well of me, but I don't think I've ever had all people speak well of me. And it will never happen, and probably you haven't either. But that can't be our goal, because personality cults often form around leaders. I'm going to repeat that one. Personality cults easily form around leaders, and it is a cancer. It is a danger. And it happens even in our meetings and in our groups, and it just sends a chill. It doesn't happen a lot, and it's happened much less this time, and maybe I'm just hypersensitive to this, and I did not just put this in my notes. It's been there for a long time. The church was very much damaged 50, 60 years ago, and some of you remember, and many of us have heard, when a particular charismatic person had a cultish following. When he fell off of the spiritual wagon, it really hurt the church. I am pleased to say, in my opinion, we do not have that now to that degree, but we do need to be extremely, extremely careful of that. It appears that maybe the church at Corinth, in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 4 through 8, had that problem a little bit. Our leaders should be esteemed for their work's sake, not for their own sake. But we need to keep a very, very cognizant handle on that. And it is easy and troubling when we, maybe without even realizing it, start to elevate one another to position. To elements of esteem larger than we ought to. Okay? And I don't quite know how far to go with this publicly, but I think it is a very, very important part. As he wrestles in his mind how much further to go with this. And I don't like to use myself as an example, but I know myself. You've seen at meetings, and you've probably, some of you have chuckled how that I'll sit on one side and other people will sit on the other side. Well, there's all kinds of humorous reasons for that. But I believe it's very important to diffuse as much as we can any group adulation. Now, you've noticed that this, well, maybe you didn't. I've sat three different places in this meeting. I sat over here, and then I sat there till I got in trouble, and then I had to go to the back. But that wasn't the only reason I moved around. Because each time I move, then I get to interface with a different group of people. And I just feel like when I'm at a meeting like this, or any meeting, that's to my advantage to have that interface and not become part of a clique, for want of a better phrase. Maybe I'll talk more about this later, and maybe I shouldn't talk more about this later, but I talked a little bit about it now. Feelings of infallibility. That can happen. That can happen. I'm pretty good. I just wish the rest of you were. But you're awful lucky to have me, because I'm good. Well, I hope you took that tongue-in-cheek. But that can suddenly start to shift into a leader who gets encouragement. He gets encouragement. But spirituality does not guarantee infallible judgment. A spirit-filled person is less likely to make poor decisions than his secular counterpart, but perfection will always elude each one of us. Even the apostles sometimes needed some divine correction, didn't they? Well, if they needed it, I guarantee you, the best leader in this assembly also needs it. And I don't know who that person is. A feeling of indispensability. A little bit the same. Oh, is the church... I wonder if they're going to be able to survive when I'm gone. Well, always keep in mind the church did fairly well before we got here. And they'll probably do as well, if not better, after we leave. I was talking to a couple last week. I won't mention their names just because I don't want to put this congregation in a spotlight. But they had a pillar of their congregation die a few years ago. And there was that natural thought, well, what's going to happen now? Well, as I was talking to this couple, we went out to dinner. They've had considerable growth in the last 2 years. Do they miss this person that's no longer with them? Absolutely. Is there life after every one of us? Absolutely. So, we are not indispensable. Sometimes we're not even tolerable. Last one I put on this slide is excessive elation or depression. I think one of the characteristics of a good leader or a great leader is an even keel. A leader may be churning on the inside, but we who are trying to follow them don't want to see panic. When the enemy attacks, who wants to follow a guy who's running around like a chicken with his head off? Nobody. I think that's one of the characteristics I see in great leaders, whether it's in the military or in the church or in the secular. It's okay to churn on the inside. That's just human. But to the extent we're going to lead, our children follow us in times of emergency because they trust us, because we're going to be calm and get them out of the mess. And I think that's also quite true within the church. Let me pause before I go to the next slide and see if anybody has a comment or a question. The next slide is not on perils of leadership, it's on the cost of leadership. So if you have something in this category, I would welcome your thoughts. Doug. Yeah. You can put Barnabas in that category. You know, it starts out Barnabas and Paul, and pretty soon it becomes Paul and Barnabas. There was a transfer of the dominant in that team, and Barnabas didn't seem to faze him. In fact, he seems to prefer it. Well, John the Baptist said, "I must decrease so that he can increase." Sometimes as we grow older, that's an important thing to remind. Now, by decrease, don't retire. But we do sometimes have to step back and let others get the experience, and maybe others who are more talented than we are. But don't retire on us. But there is a stepping back. Those are wonderful stories of people who put the Lord's work ahead of their self-egos. And that's an awfully good pattern. Anybody else care to make a comment? Steve.
Leader of the church, in a leadership capacity, and if you're in that leadership capacity, to realize what you think that it is not about us. Us serving in a congregation is not to get our moment on the stage. I mean, what in the world are we thinking if we're jealous about a brother or sister who does an edifying work within the congregation? Are you serious that you're really a leader of the church if you feel that way?
Well, yeah, and some of my things have overlapped because we talked about competitiveness yesterday or the day before, and that fits right into that. If we think like that, we are not good leaders. We then become bad leaders. And, you know, I had Kobe Bryant up here. No offense, guys, I just cannot stand the Lakers. But the Bulls I could handle. But if I'm on his team, I'm happy to get the ring. I don't care who puts the points in. Now, yeah, I would like to do something, I guess, but it's the winning of the team. Excellent. Kathy, did I see your hand?
Yes, I was feeling in the sense of going, I think you can even take that further to the lack of delegation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you train other leaders by delegation.
Absolutely. We spent last week, I think, almost a whole day on that, and I'm glad you brought it back up because others weren't there. Probably one of the greatest failings that leaders have is delegation. Yeah, she's delegating. But I that's right. If you feel indispensable or infallible, it's going to be counterintuitive to delegate. And as I told them last week, that's a little hard for me, but it's really hard for some people. I got my faults. I don't know that that's my biggest one, because I enjoy having other people do stuff instead of me. But when we delegate, as I said last week, that we don't delegate so we have less to do. We delegate so that we can do other things, and the total workload increases, not just shifts. Excellent. Thank you for bringing that up, Kathy. I don't want to miss anybody that has a good comment. If you don't have a good comment, just leave your hand down. Okay. We haven't had any bad comments. I haven't had any bad things in my box. I was taking some out yesterday, and somebody accused me. I don't know, there's three or four or five in here. Accused me of putting them in there myself just to make my box look good. But I only put two. No. But it's really nice to get, and nobody has signed, well, one, I think I've had one that was signed, which was okay, but it gives you a freedom to make comments without highlighting your congregation or a particular situation, and that's good. Okay, the next slide has to do with cost of leadership. I won't take a whole lot of time on this, but leading in the church, in the family, is a wonderful, exhilarating experience that has some things that aren't so wonderful sometimes. Okay? I wouldn't trade it for the world, and I hope you wouldn't trade it for the world. Having said that, there sometimes can be an element of loneliness. Who do the elders go talk to get their batteries charged back up? Well, if you want something to do for your leaders in your home congregation, be there to listen. Now, if an elder wants to talk to you, you need to handle that with great discretion, because that may not need to be repeated, but elders need to talk. Evangelists need to talk. Deacons need to talk. All God's children need to talk. Now, some of you get carried away with that a little bit. But because a leader must often be ahead of his followers, he often lives with an element of loneliness. And that is just a fact. I think Moses paid that price. But when I go through the Bible, every good, great leader in the Bible paid that price to some extent. Elijah got depressed. Elijah was lonely. You don't think Noah was lonesome out there hammering away on that ark with the ridicule? In 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 15, and I think I referenced this earlier, when Paul is in prison, he gets such an encouraging charge out of Onesiphorus coming to encourage him. I think Paul got lonesome. Loneliness is sometimes the leaders must pay for price, pay for their service. When people ask me, what can we do for our leaders and what can we do for each other, help them in this way. Second one I put up there was fatigue. I didn't write down who said this. It wasn't me, but I thought it was kind of interesting. It said, and I quote, "The world is run by tired men." And there's probably a lot of truth to that. You know, we look at our presidents, and I don't care what your politics are, but we always are saying, boy, they got gray fast. You know, there is a fatigue factor. Whether you agree or disagree with their politics. But it is often a price of leadership. I didn't put this one in, but I think it's important. I believe fatigue is often the cost of leadership, and the result of fatigue is mediocrity. And there's where we really hurt ourselves. When you get tired, you do not lead or perform as well as you do when you're rested. You are not listening near as well as you were 2 days ago because you're tireder. I know that. I'm probably not presenting as well because I'm tireder. Fatigue needs to be addressed in leadership. The next one I put up here was criticism. Every good and great leader gets criticized. Sometimes it's fair, sometimes it isn't. But there are few things that so kill the efficiency, the capability, and initiative of a leader than destructively presented criticism. When you go back through the Bible calls them murmurers. In the Old Testament, classic example of what God does to people that murmur. He killed them. Well, the ground may not open up and swallow you up, but if we persist in that, the day will come when we will wish it had. We will wish it had. Now, leaders are not infallible. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, it talks about how a leader can be rebuked appropriately, and I believe even removed from office if it deems it. But there is an appropriate way and an inappropriate way, and human nature usually chooses the inappropriate way. Okay. Rejection. Well, nobody likes that. But if you're trying to get things done, you're trying to lead, you will be rejected. A little bit linked to loneliness. A leader who follows the high standards of our Lord may likewise find himself being rejected. Remember what Jesus said? He came unto his own, and his own received him not. The prophet is without honor in his own home. Sadly, often the masses do not recognize a leader for the job he's done until he's gone. And then they build a monument to him with stones that they had previously used to throw at him. And that's really sad. I do several funerals, and some of you do several funerals, and it's not usually what happens at a funeral, and it's over, everyone files by the casket, and then the family comes in to have a few private moments before the casket goes down. It is very common to stand there, and the family comes and hear the family say something to the effect, I wish I had told you this while you were still alive. And there's nothing they can do. If you have good leaders, let them know it, that you appreciate it. It will go a long way. I'm not talking about being hypocritical. I'm just talking about letting them know that we do appreciate them. That they're willing to endure some of these things for us. That they're willing to do that for us. And one of the costs of leadership can be the family. Don't let it happen. There's no age at which a man can go into the office. He must have a wife and he must have children. But I think we need to exercise some care that we don't put men into the deaconship, eldership, whatever, evangelist, at times when it's going to be a hindrance to their family. I did not go into the full-time work until my boys were late teens. That is not a model for everybody. I'm not saying it that way. But it seemed to me like if Donna and I were going to have kids, I ought to try to be there to help raise them and then take some of the blame when it didn't work. We've been blessed and it has worked. But you hear this PK thing, preacher's kids, and some of you are preacher's kids. I never felt that, but I guess some people do. And I don't know when. I don't know whether they feel it or it's an excuse for their conduct. But I suspect some of them did feel it. I didn't. And I feel very fortunate about that. But it can have a toll on one's family. When you look at men who do full-time church work, the percentage of their kids that remain Christians is certainly no higher than the average, and sometimes lower. I'm not saying that's the reason. I'm just saying consider it. And not all wives can stand their husbands, not just being out of town, being that busy. Some wives can. It is a family decision. Anybody want to make a comment on cost of leadership? This is the only slide I have on it, and it's not going to do anything more than what you've seen. It's a humble slide from a humble man who's not a science teacher. Okay, that wasn't very humble, was it? But it felt good. Barry? Thank you. His comment, I think most of you could hear him, but for the tape, was that David indicated or dealt with Saul in a respectful manner when Saul really didn't deserve to be respected, but he was respecting the office. Now, that does not mean our leaders are infallible and that we can't properly challenge them on decisions if we feel they are wrong, but we need to recognize them as leaders that God has given us. And if we can't, then we need to make a change and not be rebellious. Whether that means go somewhere, I don't even like to use that word, but we shouldn't be grousers. Shouldn't be. Anybody else care to make a comment or ask a question on the cost? I'm sorry, Tom.
Moses helps me a lot. I think that he was in charge of probably a million people. None of us who are leaders have that great responsibility. So if Moses could get through it fairly well, I mean, the thing that he did that was, he's remembered for was very understandable, feeling probably a lot of these things you're talking about, giving into it. So Moses, God can help Moses, he can help us.
Okay. Bottom line of what he said is, God help Moses be a leader so he can help you. Now, I didn't do his comment justice, but that's what he said.
He was responsible for a lot more than
you. Okay. I want to deal with another question I got yesterday, which kind of segues a little bit into my next section. It's not terribly long, but it's more than one sentence. It had to do with our discussion yesterday on conflict and how to deal with it. Sometimes conflict occurs between family members and outsiders, and the family church members poo-poo the concerns of those who aren't in the inner family circle, which sometimes can be enough for outsiders to leave the group because they feel ignored or discounted. Since elders tend to come from the family, quotation marks, group, how should they lead these two groups to unification? You understand that question? Okay. Some of you understand it real well, and others of you are scratching your head. But it's very common in congregations for there to be family members. And there's a closeness. Now, I can't relate to that. I've seen it because I have never worshipped in a congregation that had more than my immediate family. I grew up with my mother, father, sister, and me. And then later it was me and my wife and my two boys. But I've never been a member of a congregation where I had aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, brothers, sisters. But many of you, dare I say most of you, have. And there is a tendency sometimes for that to get a little bit cliquish. And I'm coming back to where I jumped the gun just a little bit earlier. And sometimes, oftentimes, the officers in that group come from some of those families, and they have a special bond with their physical family, which is natural. And I think this question is, but not everyone's part of that physical family. And sometimes if you're not part of a physical family in a congregation, you can feel like you're an outsider. And I see enough heads going up and down that I know some of you have felt that way. I don't know that I've ever felt terribly that way, but I do believe that it is very important that we make everybody in our spiritual family feel equally welcome and equally a part, even if it means we suppress our natural tendency to spend a lot of time with our families in various church activities. And I cringe a little bit when after amen is said, all these little physical family huddles appear. Now, there may be times when that's important. Maybe you're talking about Uncle Joe needs help. I don't know what you're talking about because I'm not part of your family. But just put yourself, how does everyone else feel who's not part of that clique, that group? And I don't think it's done intentionally. We just need to be very cognizant of it. If you've ever visited a congregation you don't know, you know how much it means if someone comes up and talks to you versus everyone talks to everybody else and you fade out through the back door. Well, maybe you're never going to be there again in your life, but doesn't it make a difference in the way you feel about that group? So I would be I would ask us to be very, very cognizant of that. How should an elder work in unifying those two groups? He ought to treat them absolutely equal. And that doesn't mean just intellectually equal. He ought to treat them socially equal. Even if it means not having his kids over every time so that he can have someone that's not related over in his house so they feel a part of it. But it's not mutually exclusive. You could have both. I'm not saying it's wrong to have your families over. But I know a couple of congregations I go to that will not have basket dinners, as we call them, because all the families want to go and be together. Well, is that unscriptural? I haven't found that verse. Is it unwise? I found that. It's very unwise. Because it tends to not unify that spiritual family. You ever been to a church service and wondered if some of the people came for church and some of them came for a family reunion? I don't know about sure. I have. Now, I'm not trying to be judgmental because I don't know, but I'll have to admit the thought has crossed my mind. The thought has crossed my mind. So I thought that was I thought that was a relevant question. Does anybody want to comment on that before I go into what it's going to segue me into? Just be careful. Not everybody has 14 family members in the congregation, or however many. Eldon? Absolutely. He said that also affects visitors. Yeah. And I don't care how cute your grandkids are, they are not cute when they're running around during church. Find a seat and park them, says one without grandchildren. But I hope I say that when I do have them. But I don't want to get negative, but I've been up preaching and Aunt and Uncle George are over here and Grandpa and Grandma over here and these kids are just going back and forth. Well, that's bad enough, but everyone's giggling thinking it's cute. Well, you don't have to listen to me, but don't have me come if you're not going to. That was a little tongue-in-cheek, but not very. I saw a Janice. She said, would I care to comment on how family ties can affect church discipline? Well, let me first of all say how it should. Not at all. Sometimes it does. But I've seen it go both ways. But I think what you're referring to is sometimes there's a tendency to be a little more lenient on our physically loved ones than maybe someone that we're not physically close to. If that happens, that's inappropriate. We have one standard. And each case is different. I'm not saying that each case is exactly the same, but the difference is not whether they're my blood kin or not. Now, when I said I've seen it go both ways, occasionally I thought an officer be harder on his family member than he would have if it hadn't been his family member. That's my tendency. Now, I've never had to discipline my kids, but I have a scar in my heart that has nothing to do with church. My youngest was playing T-ball, which is one of the dumbest games, but it has no purpose. But anyway, Shane was up there. There was no umpire. So they said, would I umpire? I said, yeah. He hits it, and you know, in T-ball, It's like the Red Sea. When the ball gets hit, they part. And then when it stops, they flock. Well, he headed out in the outfield, and he was going around the bases. And just as he touched home plate, here comes the ball. That sucker was safe. I called him out so that nobody would accuse me of being biased. Now, it was close, but I regretted that. Now, that was a case of being hard, but that's a little different than church discipline. I have tremendous respect for our leaders and our congregations who treat their families consistent with what the Bible says, even when it sometimes means disciplining a son or a daughter. I can't think of things much harder. For me, that would be worse than a death. I think. I haven't experienced either one. But I have, and we have people here who have done that, and I have tremendous respect for that. But it does not always happen. You're right. But I think as the congregation, we need to be loving and considerate of how hard that is for that family to go through that and not be impatient with them. But it doesn't matter if it's your kid or my kid or me or you. If we need discipline, we need discipline. Anybody want to, Lowell?
This is back to the point you're talking about earlier. You and I talked about converting to the congregation and not to the church.
Yes.
Kind of, you could take that with the family. You could convert to your family and not the church, and then move somewhere else, not associated with the church Christ.
Okay. His comment was, and we and I have talked about this, but you probably have too. Sometimes people get converted to the congregation and not to the Lord. He said the church, but I'll say the Lord. And that can happen. I mean, I can't read people's hearts, but when that does happen, when something happens within the congregation, they tend to drift away because they're not converted to the Lord. Or they move away. We don't have that problem in mutual ministry, but I have seen and you have seen people get, shall we say, emotionally married to their minister. And he leaves, they leave. We had a congregation, it was a Church of Christ, not exactly my flavor, but a Church of Christ in Kansas City, and their minister went to the Christian church, and half the congregation went with him to the Christian church, which told me that maybe their depth of conversion was a little lacking. So we need to be very cognizant of that. You want to say a little more about that? Tom?
A verse that helps me a lot is the verses where Paul tells brothers to greet one another with a holy kiss. I don't think so much about using the kiss, but I think the idea there is show all, not just your family, but everybody, that you're glad to see.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I would say, Tom, that greeting with a holy kiss is not a good illustration in Iowa. Well, you Iowans are groaning. Okay. I want to talk a little bit about congregational communication. Because I believe relationships are sustained by communication. Last week we talked a little bit about business meetings. That is a form of communication. Relationships are sustained through communications, whether it's marriage, whether it's the church, whether it's workplace. They just are. And relationships are what build the church. And I believe informed people can. They won't automatically, so I said not will, but can be more productive. So I believe that in our congregations we should be informed to the extent we can be and appropriate to have to be. But it has to be a two-way street. And I put James 5:14 up there. Does anybody without looking remember what's happening in James 5:14? It's not quite to the confessing your faults. If someone is ill, it says, call upon the elders. Ever hear somebody say, I've been sick for 3 weeks and no one's come to see me? Well, that might be unfortunate, but let somebody know. Don't complain because your brothers and sisters or elders or deacons haven't been there if you haven't communicated. There is a responsibility to let people know when we have needs. We are not mind readers. two-way street. But as information is disseminated, it must be used and held in sometimes confidence, but always with discretion. In Galatians chapter 6, verse 1, ye which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness. Whose job is it to restore? Everyone who's spiritual. Somebody asked about church discipline. That is a congregational activity. Yes, our leaders have to take maybe a lead in that to bring it to a point, but it is a congregational. Elders do not, dare I use the word disfellowship people, congregations, I believe, do that as a whole, and we try to restore as a whole. Sometimes communication falls apart because of lack of trust. But again, trust is what you have to have in order to delegate. I think it's very appropriate for us to have in our announcements, such and such is struggling with, and we ask prayers for that. But spiritual health must also be shared. And we marshal all of our resources toward restoration. I guess in this little segment, and I didn't really make it a long segment, and I don't really know that I want to, but congregational communication, I think, is very important for the working of the... This meeting would not have happened without a lot of congregational communication. And if Greg and Charles had simply said, okay, this is what everyone's supposed to do, here's your sheet, go do it, it would not have had the buy-in and participation. But it does amaze me how many congregations do not communicate. They don't have business meetings, they don't... various ways. I'm not telling you how to run your congregations. I'm just saying I know communication is extremely important. Steve?
Related to this fellowship, the congregational involvement, 2 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 6, punishment which was given by the majority is sufficient for something that's related back up to the commandment in 5.
Probably so. It may not. It often isn't. Yeah. Okay. I had a thought in it, and it's escaped me. So it must not. It must have been very, very important. Oh, one of the things I think are very important about business meetings is not simply disseminating of information. You can also diffuse criticism by having periodic business meetings. If your congregation is like every congregation I've been a member of, the people who come, it's a rather small percentage of the membership who comes to the business meetings. But my theory or my belief is if you don't come, you somewhat have relinquished the right to complain. Now, you may still complain, but things get discussed there, and if at all possible, we need to be there. And that also encourages our leaders. Think how they feel when we have they call a business meeting and a third of us come. Now, the smaller your congregation, probably the higher percentage that come. But if you're in a congregation over 40, it's probably often rather small. And I think that is just unfortunate. Anybody want to make a comment on that? I'm going to skip a section here, and I don't know that I know how to do this, but we're going to find out. So if I mess this up, I'm just going to turn it off and go.
John.
Yes.
Some of the worst behavior I've ever seen among Christians has been in business, where they seem to have the idea we're not in church. I should say the coolest thing. I've seen some businesses go really well, but I've seen some that were despicable, and people never entered the door again because they saw the conduct of brothers and sisters. So I'm wondering if you have any suggestions about detecting how to conduct an effective business meeting, what's around the world, whatever.
Okay, good, because I'm messing this up. Well, that was from yesterday, so just ignore that. I was doing good till I hit. Let me go. That's an important. Because I have also seen. I was involved with a congregation, without getting too specific, and it turned into a free for all. Blows were exchanged, but they were verbal, thankfully. But it. If I had not been fairly grounded in the faith, I might have been shopping. It was nasty. Now, I haven't seen that often, but it sure can happen. Well, I think one of the officers ought to be in charge of the business meeting. And that's point number one. I like to recommend that the officers have a pre-business meeting so that not that all the decisions are made, but the church is like a family. Mom and dad don't always agree, but they don't need to iron that out in front of the kids. Two elders or deacon and elder may not agree, but I don't know that it's beneficial to iron that out in front of the congregation. So I think that may help. But if it just starts getting out of control, Barry, and all else fails, I call on someone for prayer and the business meeting's over, rather than let that turn into a real Donnybrook, because tempers flare. And sometimes it's about important issues, but sometimes it's about stupid issues. I've often said if a congregation can build a building and still be harmonious, they're in good shape, because people argue about colors and all this. And I don't know what your experience was, but anytime it gets heated, not to dodge the question, I'm more than willing to pull the plug on it and let's reconvene once people have calmed down. Do you have a thought that would be, what'd you do? Or you just saw it? Or you read about it?
This was years ago, and a reference that I had, and I had invited a new member of the church there to come, and I wish I hadn't, because he never came back after he saw the popular Christian that was there. I wasn't talking.
Okay. I don't think I've ever had a case where I saw a new member just leave because of it, but there's been a few that have been kind of ugly. I've never had one in my home congregation, thankfully. Steve.
Well, this does relate to your point of communication, because that's how trust is established. Spend time together in activities other than just regularly scheduled church meetings, and you don't know one another, you're more likely to not trust one another. So if there's any suggestion of a threat, like a business meeting, then you're likely to be a law. And the thing you said about the elders pre-meeting is very good, because it is like the parents. If the children see that mom and dad don't agree, they don't trust one another,
yeah. An officer, and I like for it to be the deacon sometimes also, depending upon the topic, I think is important. Now, when we have those meetings, officers, you need to be a little careful, because if the business meeting proceeds along, well, okay, we've already decided everything, so we're just going to tell you what we've decided, then you don't get the buy-in. But any significant issues can be ironed out there. I mean, there's a lot of issues at a business meeting I could care less. But other people, it's very important to them. Very important to them. And I'm glad it is. That's why we all, the whole body, fitly joined together. If everybody cared about wall colors and carpet as much as I do, we'd have dirt floors. And that might not be all bad, but might not be perfect either. We just put new carpeting in at Smart Road, and I just held my breath, but we made it. But that was real important. My theory is once it's been there very long, you forget what your options were, it's fine. I got some of your point in somewhere. Oh, Tom.
I wanted to emphasize your point about prayer. Like Barry said, a business meeting is not being in church, but it's still, in a way, it's kind of like having a Bible study. It's good to start with prayer. I don't come to business meetings looking for a fight, but a prayer always puts me in the right place.
One real quick one. What about you're having a business meeting and someone that's not a member of your congregation shows up? Happens all the time. Well, I'll tell you how we do about it. I'm out of time, so I'm going to tell you the right way to handle it rather than listening to you guys. No, there's not a right way. It happens to us at Smart Road because we have them on Sunday night, and visitors from other congregations are just coming to visit. So what we do is, if that happens, we have about 15, 20 minutes of songs and a couple of prayers and maybe a reading. We dismiss after 20 minutes, announce that we'll reconvene in 5 minutes to have our business meeting, which lets our visitors feel like they've not come in vain, but it gives them an opportunity to do extract themselves, because I think it's awkward for them. But bottom line is, a congregation's business is the congregation's business. It is not other people's business. Maybe it wouldn't hurt, but I have always felt a little awkward with that. Okay, you got a break.